This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Game, written and read by Neil Strauss, that being me. Step 6. Create an emotional connection. Chapter 1. Petra was a 19-year-old Czech with long chestnut hair, a thin golden-brown model's body, and no more than a dozen words of English in her vocabulary. I met her and her cousin on the island of Hvar in Croatia with a Seattle Pua named Nightlight 9. We showed them our magic tricks. They showed us their popcorn. On a piece of paper, we drew a picture with a clock and a time on it to rendezvous that night. They met us and led us by the hand to a small deserted beach. They took off all their clothes except their panties and tennis shoes and ran into the water. We followed and made love to them as they chattered away in Czech to each other. Anya was a whip-smart 22-year-old Croatian who was vacationing with her younger sister. She oozed confidence, sensuality, and good breeding. Her sister was the opposite. Nightlight 9 and I met them on the beach in the Croatian town of Vodice. That night, they slipped away from their parents, and we wandered along the waterfront until we found a docked sailboat. We snuck on board and had sex in the galley. I left 20 euros for the bottle of wine we drank. Carrie was a 19-year-old waitress at Dublin's. She approached me and complimented me on my dreadlocks. I neglected to tell her I was wearing a Rastafarian wig as a joke. I met her the next day completely bald, but we still ended up in bed together. When I emailed her the next day to tell her she'd left her rings at my house, she responded, "I don't wear rings, they're not mine." Martine was a free-spirited blonde I met in New York, with milky skin, smeared red lipstick, and an iron-on t-shirt. I'd opened so many sets that I can't even remember what I said to her. The next night we went to a bar. I brought along two other girls, so she'd have to work for me. For a second, I felt guilty about that, but only for a second. In the bar, I asked her how good she was in bed on a scale of 1 to 10. In my hotel room, I found out. She was a 7. Laranya was a Jap in the body of an Indian woman. I'd met her when I was in college, and we were both interning at the same weekly newspaper. She was the hot intern, I was the shy intern. But when I ran into her years later in Los Angeles, style took her out in the town. The first thing she said when we woke up together was, "I can't believe how much you've changed." Neither could I. Stacy was a 28-year-old anorexic I met in Chicago. During a lengthy email correspondence, she seduced me with her intelligence, candor, and poetry. When she finally came to visit, I was disappointed to discover that she was awkward and ineloquent. She probably felt the same way about me. Nonetheless, I brought her directly to my bedroom, and we began to make out. I put a finger inside her and felt a fleshy cord bisecting her vagina like a tennis net. It was her hymen. I told her I didn't want to be the one to take her virginity. That's when I realized that being a Pua sometimes meant saying no. Greta was an older Russian woman with chiseled features and a great boob job. I met her at a bar in Malibu. She told me it was her birthday, but wouldn't say her age. I guessed 45, but not out loud. As a present, I told her I'd be her boy toy. She grabbed my butt. I told her I charged extra for that. Two nights later, we had a cocktail and adjourned to my house. She said she didn't put out anymore, that she was looking for something deeper. We had sex that night. We role-played. I was the teacher. She was the naughty schoolgirl. It was her idea. She was a drunk Asian girl with large breasts, surrounded by three sober Asian girls with small breasts. I can't remember her name. She thought I was gay. We talked for 15 minutes. Then I took her by the hand and led her to the bathroom. We gave each other oral sex and never spoke again. It was overrated. Jane was an Australian businesswoman a fellow pickup artist set me up with. She had spiky blonde hair, leopard print pants, and a voracious sexual energy. When she danced, if you could call it that, every man's head turned. We fucked in her BMW, with the top down and our legs out the door. When I asked her when she'd first wanted to kiss me, she said, "As soon as I saw you." No woman had ever said that to me before. Sarah was a 40-something casting agent I met at the lounge of the Casa del Mar Hotel in Santa Monica. She looked clean and radiant, like she had stepped out of a shampoo commercial, even in the harsh light of my elevator, where an hour after meeting, we made love. She kept asking if there were cameras. I couldn't tell if she was afraid of being caught or excited by the possibility. Probably both. Hia and Randy were girls I met at the Club Highlands. Hia was a tiny indie rocker nerd with a boyfriend. Randy was a cute actress with the most mischievous smile I'd ever seen and a boyfriend. It took a month to convince Hia to cheat on her boyfriend. It took a day to convince Randy. Mika was a Japanese girl I met at Jamba Juice. She was an orange dream machine with energy boost. I am an orange dream machine with protein boost. I was intrigued. When we had sex, I discovered that she didn't believe in shaving her pubic hair. The next morning, she told me, "I grow my hair out because I donate it to children with cancer." I was astonished. "They wear your pubes on their head?" She replied that she'd been talking about the hair on her head. Maya was a black-haired goth belly dancer I flirted with at one of her performances. When our paths crossed months later, she still remembered me. I invited her over the next night. Her car was in the shop, so I offered to pay for a cab. She was there in half an hour. Alexis was a clothing store manager who looked like she should have been in an 80s new wave band. Susanna was a recently divorced designer who wanted to rediscover her sexuality. Doris was a married woman whose sex life had died. Nadia was a librarian who had the skills of a porn star. I guess you can learn a lot from books. All four were the result of an experiment. I tried to concoct the perfect routine for the personals. After several failures, I succeeded. The secret, I learned, was to seem like a selfish prick in the ad, and then to be a fascinating, laid-back gentleman on meeting. Maggie and Linda were sisters. They're no longer talking to each other. Anne was a French girl who didn't speak a word of English. Jessica was a bookworm I met on jury duty. Sarah helped me call a tow truck when my car broke down. Steph was handing out flyers for a strip club on Sunset Boulevard. Susan was a friend's sister. Tanya was a neighbor. My wish had come true. Women were no longer a challenge. They were a pleasure. In the months since Mystery's breakdown, I'd turned a new corner in my game. Once I'd gotten the number of a woman, it was easy to meet and have sex with her. In the past, I was too obsessed with trying to get some to actually take a step back, assess the situation, and act appropriately. Now, after a year of accumulating knowledge and experience, I had finally gotten out of my own head. I understood the process of attraction and the signals women gave. I saw the big picture. When talking to a woman, I could recognize the specific point when she became attracted to me, even if she was acting distant or felt uncomfortable. I knew when to talk and when to shut up, when to push and when to pull, when to tease and when to be sincere, when to kiss and when to say we were moving too fast. Whatever test, challenge, or objection a woman threw my way, I knew how to respond. When Maya the belly dancer wrote and said, "Thanks for the multiple orgasms. Call and we can discuss when you'll be taking me out for dinner. You owe me for the cab ride, and I feel like being taken out on a real date," I didn't assume she was being a bitch or pushy at all. She was just trying to get validation for having put out so quickly and testing to see how much she could control me. I didn't even need to think about the response. "I'll tell you what," I wrote. "I'll pay you back for the cab like I promised, and then you can take me out to dinner in exchange for all those orgasms." She took me out to dinner. I saw the Matrix. I was Mystery. Chapter 2. Who is the Best Pua? By Thundercat. From Thundercat's Seduction Lair. Okay, so the debate has been raging for a while now over who is the best pickup artist out there. Obviously, a lot of egos are involved in this assessment, and everyone has their own opinions about who the best really is. In fact, it's so subjective that I don't really think there will ever be a clear and honest answer on the subject. It's like asking who the best warrior or soldier is in a war. But that doesn't stop some people from categorizing the people in our little community as the best. So I've decided to rate the top puas operating out there. Style is definitely, hands down, bar none, the best operating in the game today. This guy is probably the most evil, sneaky, manipulative bastard I have ever seen in operation. The thing is, this guy comes in totally under the radar, and that is why he's so dangerous. His subtlety is so amazing that before you know it, you are qualifying yourself to him, and he has you right where he wants you. And the thing is, he does it with both girls and guys. No one is safe. To give you an idea of how incredible style is, he's invented most of the techniques a lot of the top guys are using and teaching. He is practically Machiavellian in nature, and is someone I both admire and fear. Chapter 3. It was when I went to Croatia, after Mystery's breakdown, that I realized everything had changed. I was no longer in the game to meet women. I was in the game to lead men. Two of the Croatian pickup artists I was staying with had even shaved their head in emulation of pictures of me they had seen online. Despite my aversion to being a guru, I had clearly become one. When I talked to a woman, the room went silent. The guys leaned in close to hear what I was saying, pulling out notebooks to write my words down and commit them to memory. On returning home, I watched Ross Jeffries run a variation of my jealous girlfriend opener about a woman who doesn't want her boyfriend to speak to his ex from college, followed by a false time constraint. Afterward, he even emailed and asked for a copy of my evolution phase shift routine. He was modeling me, and he planned on sharing these techniques in his seminars. Then Thundercat's PUA ranking came out, and I was number one. I could no longer claim to be a student. Neil Strauss was officially dead. In the eyes of these men, I was Style, the king of the unnaturals. All over the world, people were using my jokes, my comebacks, my lines, my words, to meet, kiss, and fuck girls. I had overshot my goal. In the old days, I was just Mystery's wing, or Ross's disciple, or Steve P's hypnotic subject. Now I had to prove myself every time I went out. Guys in the community would ask behind my back, "How is Style? Is he any good?" If I didn't walk up to a group of girls and make out with the hottest one within 15 minutes, they'd think I was a fraud. Before I joined the community, I had been afraid of failing in front of women. Now I was afraid of failing in front of men. And the pressure ran both ways. I also began to develop unreasonable expectations of myself. If I was at an Italian restaurant and there was an alluring woman five tables away, I felt like a failure if I didn't sarge her. If I was walking to the dry cleaners and an aspiring actress model waitress passed by, I felt like a hypocrite if I didn't open her. And where simply talking to a stranger was enough to elate me in my AFC days, now I needed to have her in my bed within a week. Though I knew my new mindset was seriously warped, I felt more ethical in many ways as a PUA than I had been as an AFC. Part of learning game was not just memorizing openers and phone game and rapport building tactics, but learning how to be honest with a woman about what I expected from her and what she could expect from me. It was no longer necessary to deceive a woman by telling her I wanted a relationship when I just wanted to get laid, by pretending to be her friend when I only wanted to get in her pants, by letting her think we were in a monogamous relationship when I was seeing other women. I had finally internalized the idea that women don't always want relationships. In fact, once unleashed, a woman's physical needs are often more ravenous than a man's. It's just that there are certain barriers and programming walls to be overcome in order for her to feel comfortable enough to surrender to them. So every part of the pickup is designed simply to anticipate and disarm objections, at least when we're talking about solid game as opposed to fool's mate. The opener, for example, is casual. It's not perceived as a pickup attempt. You're just being a friendly stranger when you walk up and ask her and her friends, "My neighbor just bought two dogs, and she wants to name them after an 80s or 90s pop duo. Do you have any ideas?" When you start talking to a group of people, their first concern is, "Are we going to be stuck with this guy all night? How do we get rid of him?" So you give yourself a false time constraint. "I can only stay for a minute," you tell them as you join their group, "because I need to get back to my friends." As you interact, you pay attention to the people who seem most likely to shut you out, the jealous men, the overprotective friends. You make them feel good about themselves as you challenge, tease, and neg the target. If she interrupts you, for example, say, "Wow, is she always like that? How do you deal with her?" If she looks shocked, you reel her back in with a light compliment. This is what I call push-pull, keeping her guessing by pushing her away and then quickly pulling her in closer. After they're finished giving opinions on names for the dogs, Millie and Vanilli, Hall & Oates, Dre and Snoop, I've heard them all, then you demonstrate value. You give the girls the best friends test, or teach them something about their body language, or analyze their handwriting. Then you pretend like you have to get back to your friends. Now, they don't want you to leave. You're in. You've shown them that you're the most interesting, fun person in the room. This is the hook point. You can now relax and enjoy their company. You can listen to them, find out about their lives, and make a real connection. In a best-case scenario, you can take the group or your target on an instant date to another bar, club, cafe, or party. Now you're part of the group. You may relax, tease, enjoy, and bond with your target, who is becoming attracted to you after the negging and after leading her group. When it comes time to leave, tell the group you lost your friends and need a ride home. This will give the woman an opportunity to be alone with you without letting her friends know she plans to sleep with you. If the logistics are too difficult, get her number and make a plan to hang out later in the week. When she pulls up to your house, invite her in to show her that thing you were talking about. A website, a song, a book, a movie clip, a shirt, a bowling ball, whatever. But first, give her another false time constraint. Tell her you have to get to sleep early because you have a lot of work tomorrow. Say, you can only come in for 15 minutes, and then I'm going to have to kick you out. By this point, you both may know you're going to have sex, but you still have to play a solid game so she can tell herself later that it just happened. Show her around the house, get her a drink. Tell her you're dying to play her a really funny 5-minute video clip. Unfortunately, the TV in your living room is broken, but there's one in your bedroom. Of course, there are no chairs in your bedroom, only a bed. When she sits on the bed, position yourself as far away from her as possible. Allow her to feel comfortable, perhaps even confused that you're not hitting on her. If you touch her, pull back afterward. Continue using a combination of time constraints and push-pull to amp her attraction. Keep telling her she has to leave soon. Then, at your leisure, tell her she smells nice. Sniff her slowly, from the bottom of her neck to just below her ear. This is when you use the evolution phase shift routine. Smell her, bite her arm, let her bite your neck, bite her neck, and then kiss. Unless she attacks you with lust, as you physically escalate, continue talking to keep her mind occupied and pulling back just before she starts to get uncomfortable. You should always be the first one to object. This is called stealing her frame. The goal now is simply to arouse her without making her feel pressured, used, or uneasy. You make out, you remove her shirt, she removes your shirt, you start to remove her bra. What's this? She's stopping you from going any further? The PUAs have a name for this, last minute resistance, or LMR. Back up 1 or 2 steps, then continue. Wash, rinse, repeat. It's not real. It's just ASD, anti-slut defense. She doesn't want you to think she's easy. So you cuddle, you talk. She asks dumb questions like how many siblings you have. You answer honestly and make her feel comfortable again. Then you start from the top. You make out, then remove her bra. She lets you this time. You suck her breasts. She arches her back. She's aroused now. She gets on top of you and starts grinding. You're hard. You're excited. You want her. You lift her off and begin to unbutton her pants. She pulls your hand away. You're right. This is so bad, you agree, breathing heavily into her ear. We shouldn't be doing this. You make out more. You reach for the pants again. Wash, rinse, repeat. But she still stops you. So you blow out the candles, turn on the light, turn off the music, and ruin the atmosphere. Then you grab your laptop computer and check your email while she lies there confused. This is called a freeze out. She was feeling good a moment ago, enjoying your attention, your touch, and the intimacy of the room. Now you're taking it all away. She rolls over and starts kissing your chest, trying to reel you back in. You put down your computer, turn off the light, and return her affection. You reach for her pants. She stops you. She says you just met. You tell her that you understand and turn on the light again. She asks what you're doing. You tell her that when a woman says no, you respect that, but it just pushes a button in you that turns everything off. You are not upset. You tell her this in a matter-of-fact voice. She rolls on top of you and whines playfully, "No." She wants to have sex. All she needs to know is that you're going to call her afterward so that she feels good about what she did, even if she doesn't actually want to see you again. You let her know that. You tell her, take off your pants. She does. You enjoy yourselves and give each other many orgasms over the course of the night, the morning, and perhaps even for years afterward. One morning, she asks you how many women you've been with. This is the only time you're allowed to lie. Chapter 4. As a community, we had reached a new height of arrogance. I'm starting to feel like I'm hunting rabbits with a howitzer, Mad Dash, a former student, told me. He had just returned from pulling off one of the most unlikely sarges in community history. A Chicago office worker named Jackie Kim had accidentally forwarded her highly judgmental review of a date to her entire address book. It was just as shallow as the field reports of some PUAs. "So where do I stand on the date?" she wrote. "The car, the money, the job, the cute apartment, the boat, which, by the way, only seats 6 people, so I really don't consider that really amazing. His mannerism and his great kiss will probably lock in another date. But I can tell you now, unless he cuts his hair and sends me gifts, it won't lead me to seek anything other than my first 30-year-old friend. The post became an internet phenomenon, forwarded around the globe and chronicled in the Chicago Tribune. One person who received the email was Mad Dash, who promptly sent her a sympathetic response. Jackie wrote him back, saying the email made her day, and she read it every time she received a hate letter. A few emails, an exchange of photos, and one date later, she was in Mad Dash's bed. It took no gifts, no boats, no haircut, just pure seduction. Mad Dash's success set off a rash of copycat Sarges in the community. Suddenly, just going out to a bar and bringing a girl home seemed too ordinary and easy. Vision called an escort and paid her $350 for an hour. His goal was to be so interesting and seductive that she would pay him to spend the next hour together. He managed to tease her out of $80 at the rate of $20 per hour. They continued to see each other afterward, free of charge. Grimble auditioned for a television show called Elimidate, in which 4 men compete for a date with a model. He won. He then went on to seduce a 19-year-old girl who came to his door selling magazines. Despite the fact that he was wearing boxers and a dirty sweater, he fucked her within an hour, and he didn't even buy a magazine. After hearing about Mad Dash, Vision, and Grimble's latest antics, any Pua who had been disillusioned with the community after Mystery's breakdown was soon back in the game, full throttle. And the fullest throttle of them all was Papa. Papa's pledge to study for law school had lasted a month. Then he went on a road trip around the country, visiting all the Puas he could. I couldn't tell whether he was still learning game or just trying to build his social circle. I don't think he knew either. He was simply imitating what he'd seen me do. Travel around the world, meet different Puas, and become the best. There was one fledgling Pua, in particular, whom Papa bonded with. A 22-year-old Canadian who discovered the pickup scene when his mother stumbled across a seduction website. He called himself Tyler Durden, after the seditious character in Fight Club. And like a virus or a demagogue, choose your simile, he would eventually change the course of the community and everyone in it. He was a philosophy student at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Beyond that, not much else was known about him or would ever be known about him. He claimed to have been one of the biggest drug dealers in Kingston. He claimed to come from a rich family. He claimed to have written rigorous philosophy papers for academic journals. He claimed to have been a bodybuilder, but no one really knew. Tyler hit the seduction boards like a hurricane. Before anyone had even met him, one thing was clear. He was obsessed to a degree beyond what any of us had seen before. He read the posting archives, thousands of pages long, of every master Pua in the game, and he was whipping through the list of recommended books, from Introducing NLP to Mastering Your Hidden Self, at a furious rate. He was a knowledge junkie. Within a couple of months, he had consumed nearly every piece of relevant information on seduction and reinvented himself as a self-styled authority, delivering stream-of-consciousness essays and field reports full of impressive feats in braggadocio. Like thumbtacks to a magnet, the seduction boys were up his ass. He was a manic new voice, an instant do-it-yourself guru. And soon, he was Papa's trusted wing. He joined Papa on his journey to spend face time with every seducer with a silly nickname. And one of them, naturally, was me. Tyler Durden emailed me constantly. He was a persistent little brat, as I suppose I had been. He seemed to pride himself on being a provocateur. Chapter 5. Mystery was back. Number 9, his roommate, called and told me Mystery had been released from the hospital and was staying with his family. He was expecting him back at the apartment the following week, when Tyler Durden would be driving in to take a one-on-one workshop. It was probably too soon to be teaching again, but Mystery needed to pay the rent, and Tyler was determined to meet him. I came out of the strange emotional journey with some incredible cognitive models, Mystery told me a few days later. His voice was Anthony Robbins clear again, his mind lucid. Everything appeared to matter once more. However, something seemed different. He was in manic mode, more so than ever, but it was a new type of manic mode. He hadn't exactly returned. He had transformed. I have my life goals set, he continued. The motivational carrots are all dangling properly in front of me. This year, I will build the foundation to take down Copperfield. I've decided to beat him. I am a superstar. My brain pupated into a butterfly. I asked him if he was on any medication. He said he wasn't. I have given it a great deal of thought, he went on. I only get depressed when I isolate myself. Look at what got me there. The pair bond break with Patricia, no career momentum, and being alone in the apartment with no one to talk to. So we need to design a social environment with people to motivate me. We can all motivate each other. While I was at the hospital, I took a lot of notes on this idea. I showed them to my psychiatrist. Even he was impressed. I'm calling it Project Hollywood. That moment was the first time I heard the phrase Project Hollywood. I didn't think much about it at the time. I figured it would end up like Project Bliss, another stillborn scheme consigned to the trash can of mental masturbation. I shine, he went on. I can see this now. I'm a superstar, just like I'm tall. I'm simply a superstar who's been holding himself back. And I'd like you to come be a star with me. It was good to have Mystery back. Flawed though he was, he had a certain charm. Some would call it narcissism, and they wouldn't be wrong, but at least he saw greatness reflected not just in the mirror, but also in the potential of those around him. That's what had made him such an influential teacher. Dude, I'm already a star, at least in the community, I told him. While you were gone, I was voted number one pickup artist, above even you. It's insane. A guy from England, I've never even met before, called the other day and said he pretends to be me when he's fucking girls. It makes him feel more powerful. What do you think of that? It was getting harder to live up to my name. One of our former students, Superstar, a ruggedly handsome teacher from South Carolina, had recently posted, "When I die and go to pick up heaven, Style will be there waiting for me because he is a pickup god." Mystery laughed when he heard it. "That's something you're going to have to come to grips with," he said. "You've created an alter ego that you are." Chapter 6. Mystery wanted to book me for 3 months straight. He planned to schedule workshops in London, Amsterdam, Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, Austin, Los Angeles, Boston, San Diego, and Rio. But I couldn't commit to the time. I needed to resuscitate my career. There was something I used to do before I was a full-time pickup artist, or, as the kids now called me, an MPUA, a master pickup artist. It was called writing. Somewhere, in another life, I used to wake up in the morning, sit at a desk before even eating or showering, and stew in my own filth as I sat typing on a computer and not getting laid. Now that I was mastering this whole girl thing, I needed to put the other pieces of my life back in balance. All the sergeant was starting to scramble my brain. I was becoming too dependent on female attention, allowing it to be my sole reason for leaving the house besides food. In the process of dehumanizing the opposite sex, I had also been dehumanizing myself. So I told Mystery that I was going to cut back on the whole sergeant thing. I was currently seeing 8 girls in LA. My dance card was full. There was Nadia and Maya and Mika and Hia and Carrie and Hillary and Susanna and Jane. They had needs, and there were no strings attached. They knew I was seeing other women, and they were probably seeing other guys. I didn't know, didn't care, and didn't ask. All that mattered was that when I called them, they came. And when they called me, I came. Everybody came. What I didn't tell Mystery was that I didn't trust him anymore. I wasn't going to set aside time and buy plane tickets, only to have him break down on me again. I wasn't a babysitter. Trust, I always told women, is something you must earn, and he would have to earn my trust again. It didn't take Mystery long to find 2 willing and enthusiastic wings to replace me, Tyler Durden and Papa. I wasn't surprised. Since Mystery had gotten out of the hospital, the pair was constantly in Toronto, staying at his apartment and vacuuming every shred of pickup information from his brain. Mystery would call every day to fill me in on their progress. He'd say, "I've finally figured out the formula for getting rapport with a woman. Are you ready to hear it?" Big pause. "Rapport equals trust plus comfort." He'd say, "When you meet Tyler Durden, don't expect to like him. Only expect to tolerate him. He makes rationalizations constantly." "Then why do you hang out with him?" "He'll He'll call and say he's coming for the weekend, and I just let him. He's like a thorn in my side that gets me out of the house. So should I let him stay at my place when he comes to town with Papa? He's part of the Pua family. Just think of him as the annoying cousin who farts a lot. 1 week later, Papa and Tyler Durden were on my doorstep. Papa actually looked somewhat cool. He wore a leather jacket, sunglasses pushed up on his forehead, and an expensive cotton dress shirt untucked over jeans. Behind him was the palest non-albino human being I had ever seen. A shock of orangey blonde stuck straight up from his ovoid head like a toy troll. His head was cocked upward, his smile seemed like a plastic snap-on attachment, and his features were flattened, as if pressed back by an invisible stocking. Though he claimed online to be an avid weightlifter, his body and face were doughy. Technically, he was a small person. He just had a certain genetic softness. This was Tyler Durden. He reminded me of Heat Miser from The Year Without a Santa Claus. He nodded at me when he walked in. No word of greeting, and a pet peeve, no eye contact. I don't trust people who don't look me in the eye when they meet me, but I gave him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he was nervous about making a good first impression. In his writings, he constantly referenced my posts and techniques. He looked up to me, they all did, but most were humble about it. Tyler Durden reacted to being uncomfortable by acting aloof and arrogant. Fine, Bono from U2 does that too. Maybe that's just their thing. When we went out to dinner, Tyler opened up. In fact, he talked nonstop, without even pausing between sentences. It was difficult to get a word in edgewise. He liked to talk in circles around a point, rather than getting directly to it. He was a victim of a disease called thinking too much. My head spun listening to him. I was busting on this girl Michelle, he was saying. I was busting on her hard. Hard to fucking busting, dude. And here he'd pull his head back, and purse his mouth, and raise his eyebrows and start nodding. The gesture was meant to convey how hard the busting was, but it looked strange and artificial. Then this dude comes up to her and is like, Michelle, you are so cute, you are the bomb. And she looks at me and goes, here he'd smirk and speak in a whiny falsetto to imitate her. I hate it when guys do that. Now I will never ever like him. I only want a guy who doesn't want me. I hate guys who want me. I hate it. After an hour of blather, I started to understand Tyler Durden. Human interaction to him was a program. Behavior was determined by frames and congruence and state and validation and other big chunk psychological principles. And he wanted to be the Wizard of Oz, the little guy behind the curtain, pulling the strings that made everyone around him think he was a big and powerful master of the realm. I got it. I liked getting it. Now here's the context. He grew up physically and mentally slow for his age, he said. His father, a football coach, imposed high standards on him that he could never meet. This was all the biographical detail I was able to gather. It felt like a lot of hard information coming from him, and I still didn't know if it was truthful. Every time the waitress came to the table, Tyler Durden wanted me to demonstrate a routine on her. Do the jealous girlfriend opener, he'd say. Show me C's versus U's, he'd say. Do the cube, he'd say. Vision had told me earlier that Tyler Durden constantly pestered him for routines and material. He told me that he had kicked him out of the house. Tyler Durden didn't seem to see the humanity in us. He didn't care about what we did for work, where we were from, what our thoughts on culture, politics, and the world were. There was a distinction he didn't seem to understand. We weren't just Puas. We were people. Chapter 7. Despite everything, I wanted to like Tyler Durden. Everyone else seemed to. As he and Papa traveled the country, winging workshops with Mystery, the reports of his skills were stellar. Perhaps he'd just been nervous around me. Or maybe he'd improved after being forced to perform for so many students as I had. I decided to give him the benefit of the doubt. There were trends in the community. Ross Jeffries and Speed Seduction had ruled the seduction boards when I arrived over a year ago. Then Mystery Method took over, followed by David D'Angelo and Cocky Funny. Now, Tyler Durden and Papa were on the rise. The funny thing was that although the methods kept changing, women weren't. The community was still so underground that few women, if any, knew what we were up to. These were trends that had nothing to do with females and everything to do with male ego. I called Ross a couple nights later and invited him to dinner for old time's sake. He wasn't as angry as I thought he'd be, chiefly because his mind was consumed by someone else, Tyler Durden. "The guy gives me the willies," Ross said. "There's something creepy about his lack of ordinary human warmth. I wouldn't be surprised if sooner or later he breaks from mystery and just teaches totally on his own. He's uncomfortable around people who are more powerful than him. Besides, he's already claiming to be better than mystery." Though I wrote the comment off as more of Ross's competitive paranoia, Tyler Durden soon proved him right. "And it was my fault, according to Mystery." "The workshops aren't fun anymore," Mystery complained. He was calling from New Jersey, where he was reined in with Tyler Durden and Papa at the home of a Pua named Garvelis, who invented toys for a living. "They're just work. These things are only fun when you come with, because then we get to wing each other." I was flattered, though workshops weren't supposed to be fun. As the name implied, they were work. "Besides, my goals are changing," he continued. "It started with wanting attention. Now I think I'm looking for love. I want to be in a relationship where I can feel butterflies in my stomach. I want a woman I can respect for her art, like a singer or a super hot stripper." The inevitable split came soon after. Mystery flew to England and Amsterdam with Tyler and Papa to teach another round of workshops. When he left with glowing reviews and numerous requests for an encore performance, Tyler Durden and Papa stayed behind to run a few workshops of their own to satisfy the demand. They were on break from college, and teaching men how to pick up women seemed a lot more appealing as an interim job than scooping ice cream or working at the local Baby Gap. Mystery phoned as soon as he returned to Toronto. "My father has lung cancer, so he's on his way out," he said. "It's strange, but the first person I wanted to call was you. So how do you feel about it?" "I'm not upset, but my mom was crying, and it's the first time I've ever seen her cry. Dad always wanted whiskey poured on his grave, so my brother said, I just hope he doesn't mind me filtering it through my bladder first." Mystery laughed. I tried to force a chuckle out for his sake, but it didn't come. The image wasn't funny to anyone who didn't hate the guy. Meanwhile, Tyler Durden and Papa were running wild in Europe. At first, they pretty much taught Mystery's material, but that all changed one night in London, when they came into their own in the great outdoors of Leicester Square, ground zero for backpackers, clubbers, tourists, players, and drunks. It was here that AMOGging was born. The AMOG is the alpha male of the group, a constant thorn in the side of Sargers. There's nothing more humiliating than having a lumbering high school quarterback who reeks of alcohol pick you up from behind and make fun of your peacocking gear in front of the girls you're trying to game. It's a constant reminder that you are not one of the popular kids, that you're just a closet nerd faking it. Tyler Durden may have been the biggest closet nerd of us all, but what he lacked in coolness and grace, he made up for in analysis. He was a social deconstructionist and behavioral micromanager. He could watch a human interaction and break it down to the physical, verbal, social, and psychological components that powered it. And AMOGing, or cutting a competitive male cockblock out of a set, appealed to his subversive side. Stealing a woman from the jocks who used to pick on him in school was a taste far sweeter than simply seducing a woman sitting alone in a cafe. So he watched the body language AMOGs used to lower his status in sets. He observed the eye contact they used to signify to girls that he was a creep. He analyzed the way they'd pat him on the back with so much force that he'd lose his balance. Soon he was spending more time in the field studying AMOGs than sergeant women, until he slowly and painstakingly laid out a new social order, where, to paraphrase the musician Boyd Rice, the strong live off the weak and the clever live off the strong. Now, nothing could stop the Puas. They could steal girls right out from under the disbelieving eyes of boyfriends the size of refrigerators. They were stepping into dangerous territory. Chapter 8. When the reviews of Tyler Durden and Papa's London workshop hit Cliff's List, Mystery was outraged. He wasn't upset about AMOGing. You had to give the pair credit for that. He was upset because Tyler Durden and Papa had set up their own website and rival company. Mystery had called his classroom seminars social dynamics. They called their infield workshops real social dynamics. Papa was as robotic about setting up his seduction business as he had been about sarging. He copied Mystery's model to the letter. Mystery now charged $600. So did Tyler and Papa. Mystery now scheduled his workshops for 3 nights. So did Tyler and Papa. Mystery started his lessons at 8:30 p.m. and ended them at 2:30 a.m. So did Tyler and Papa. Though Tyler Durden and Papa say that Mystery gave them permission to run their own workshops, Mystery claimed they used his client list and never asked him. When they exhausted that, they went around and spoke to the speed seduction lairs, drumming up business from Ross Jeffries' disciples. And when Ross began to smell a rat, they started their own lair in each region, beginning with PLAY for Players Los Angeles Yahoo Group in Southern California. Where Mystery limited his workshops to 6 people, Papa and Tyler Durden packed in dozens. It was Sergeant Anarchy, but they were rolling in money. At nearly every workshop, Papa handpicked a student, even if he happened to be a virgin, and made him a guest instructor at the next workshop. Soon, Papa had his own gang of wings that he was flying around to each workshop. There was Jay Lex, a San Francisco karaoke champ. Sick Boy, a square-jawed New Yorker in the fashion industry. Dreamweaver, a college junior and former Mystery student. And even Extra Mask, from Mystery's first workshop. Despite all this, Mystery continued to let Tyler and Papa stay at his house and pick his brain whenever they were in Toronto. When I asked him why, he answered, "Keep your friends close and your enemies closer." With a wonderful cliche like that, I assumed he knew what he was doing. In the meantime, after seeing Tyler and Papa's success, 2 things dawned on the rest of the community. The first was that anybody could run a workshop. It didn't take any special talent to point 2 girls out to a guy and say, "Go approach them." The second was that the demand for seduction schooling was elastic. Guys would throw any amount of money at the problem to solve it. Mystery had made a crucial mistake. He didn't give his students non-disclosure agreements, and now the genie was out of the bottle. One by one, everyone woke up to the notion that all those hours they had spent studying and practicing seduction, more time than they spent with family, school, work, and real-life friends, had more applications than just keeping the prophylactic industry healthy. We were the creators and beneficiaries of a body of knowledge that was light years beyond the rest of the mating world. We had developed an entirely new paradigm of sexual relations, one that gave men the upper hand, or at least the illusion of having the upper hand. There was a market for this. Orion, the spaz who had made the Magical Connections videos, started leading daytime workshops in shopping malls and on campuses. Next, 2 PUAs named Harmless and Schematic began advertising their own workshops, which was a surprise to everyone, considering that Schematic had only lost his virginity a month beforehand. One of the Croatians I had met, Bad Boy, a charismatic PUA who limped and only had partial use of his left arm after getting hit by sniper fire during the war, started a company called Playboy Lifestyle. Students flew to visit him in Zagreb for training on how to become an alpha male. Exercises included punching Bad Boy in the stomach and yelling, "Fuck you, Bad Boy," as loud as they could. The average monthly salary in Croatia was $400. His workshops cost $850 per student. Wilder and Sensei, both Mystery Method graduates, led Pickup 101 workshops out of San Francisco. A mysterious website appeared, offering a book called Neg Hits Explained. Thundercat released an ebook about approaching to help fund the promotion of a short film he had made. 3 college students in London, Angel, Ryobi, and Lockstock, started teaching workshops called Impact Interaction. And even Screwdriver, the border-crossing hooker fucker, put out a rambling 6-CD Advanced Sexual Attraction Home Study course that doubled as unintentional comedy. Finally, Grimble and Two-Timer jumped into the fray, each developing his own method of seduction and writing an ebook on it. Grimble made $15,000 the week his was released. Two-Timer took in $6,000. The community was blossoming with enterprise. I realized that it was time for me to move. This was getting too big. The lid was going to blow. I'd been in the community for 1.5 years since taking Mystery's first workshop. It was time to stake a claim on the seduction subculture before another writer beat me to it. It was time to reveal myself. It was time to remind myself that I wasn't just a PUA. I was a writer. I had a career. So I called an editor I knew at the style section of the New York Times. It seemed like an appropriately named section to write for. No one ever posted their real names online. We called each other by our nicknames. Even Ross Jeffries and David D'Angelo were pseudonyms. Our real-world jobs and identities were unimportant. Thus, everyone in the community knew me as Style. Few, if anyone, knew my real name, or that I wrote for the Times. It wasn't easy to get the story into the newspaper. It took 2 months of going back and forth with editors, writing draft after draft. They wanted more skepticism. They wanted proof of the powers of the various gurus. They wanted the inherent weirdness of the techniques to be acknowledged. They seemed to have trouble believing that these people and this world really existed. Chapter 9. The night before the story on my double life as a pickup artist was published, I slept fitfully. I had created this character's style. Now, in 2,000 words of newsprint, I was going to kill him. I was sure everyone in the community would be pissed off that there had been a traitor in our midst. I had nightmares of sergeants gathering outside my house with torches to burn me alive. But no amount of fretting and worrying could have prepared me for the response. There was none. Sure, there was a little bit of belly aching about the community being exposed and potentially ruined. A few people didn't like the tone of the story, and Mystery resented being called a pickup artist rather than a Venusian artist, his latest neologism. But Styles' credibility was safe. He had become so entrenched in the community that to the sergers of the world, he was a pickup artist first and a journalist second. Instead of being upset at Neil Strauss for infiltrating their community, they were proud of Style for getting an article in the New York Times. I was flabbergasted. I hadn't killed Style at all. I'd only made him stronger. Sargers Googled my name and ordered my books on Amazon, writing long posts detailing my career. When I asked them to keep my real world and my online identity separate, especially since I didn't want women I met looking up field reports I'd written about them, they actually agreed. I was still in charge. Even more surprising, I didn't want to leave the subculture. I was a guru now to these kids, and I had a role to fill. I had friendships to maintain. Though I'd more than attained my goal as a pickup artist, along the way, I had accidentally found the sense of camaraderie and belonging that had eluded me my whole life. Like it or not, I was an integral part of the community now. The kids were right not to feel shocked or betrayed. I was one of them. As for the women in my life, the article also had little effect. I'd already told them about the community and my involvement in it. And in doing so, I discovered a curious phenomenon. If I told a woman that I was a pickup artist before sleeping with her, she'd still have sex with me, but she'd make me wait a week or two longer just to ensure that she was different from all the other girls. If I told a girl I was a pickup artist after sleeping with her, she was usually amused and intrigued by the whole idea, and convinced I hadn't been running game on her. However, her tolerance for the community only lasted until we broke up or stopped seeing each other, at which point it was used against me. The problem with being a pickup artist is that there are concepts like sincerity, genuineness, trust, and connection that are important to women. And all the techniques that are so effective in beginning a relationship violate every principle necessary to maintaining one. Shortly after the article came out, I received a phone call from Will Dana, the features editor at Rolling Stone. "We're doing a cover story on Tom Cruise," he told me. "That's great," I said. "Yeah, he wants you to do it." "Would you mind specifying the pronoun? Who do you mean by he?" "Tom Cruise asked for you specifically." "Why?" "I've never interviewed an actor before." "He read that article you wrote in the Times on the pickup guys. You can ask him about it when you see him. He's in Europe right now scouting for locations for the next Mission Impossible, but he wants to go to wheelie school with you when he gets back." "What's wheelie school?" "It's where you learn to do motorcycle wheelies." "Sounds cool. I'm in." I neglected to tell Will that I'd never ridden a motorcycle in my life. However, it was high on the list of seduction-related skills I wanted to learn, just above improv classes and below self-defense. Step 7. Extract to a seduction location. Chapter 1. He was the first person I'd met since joining the seduction community who didn't let me down. His name was Tom Cruise. "This is going to be great, man," he greeted me when I met him at wheelie school. He smiled, complimented my adventurousness, and smashed a friendly elbow into my chest. It was the exact same amogging gesture that Tyler Durden had written about in London. He wore black bike leathers with a matching helmet tucked under his left arm and 2 days of stubble on his chin. "I'm training to jump a trailer," he said. He pointed to a mobile home sitting just off the track. "It'll be bigger than that one, but it's not that hard." He squinted at the vehicle for a moment, visualizing the feat. "Well, the jumping's not that hard. It's the landing that's difficult." He cocked his right hand and slugged me in the shoulder. Tom Cruise was the perfect specimen. He was the AMOG that Tyler Durden and Mystery and everyone else in the seduction community had been trying to emulate. He had a natural ability to remain dominant, physically and mentally, in any social situation without seeming to exert any effort. And he was the living embodiment of all six of Mystery's five characteristics of an alpha male. Nearly everyone in the community had studied his films to learn body language and regularly used terminology from Top Gun in the field. There was so much I wanted to ask him, but first I needed to confirm something. So what made you pick me for this article? The dust lifted off the track and blew around us as we clutched our bike helmets under our arms. I dug your New York Times piece, he replied. You were writing about the dating guys. So it was true. He paused and his eyes narrowed to slits, indicating that he was speaking about a serious topic. His left eye closed a little more than the right one, giving the appearance of deep intensity. Now, is that guy you wrote about in your article really saying that the character in Magnolia is based on him? Is he saying that? He was talking about Ross Jeffries. One of Ross's claims to fame was that he was the inspiration for Frank T.J. Mackey in Paul Thomas Anderson's film Magnolia. Mackey was the character Cruise played, an arrogant seduction teacher with unresolved father issues who wears a headset during his seminars and orders his students to respect the cock. He shouldn't, Cruise continued. He swallowed a salt pill and chased it down with a long swig of bottled water. That's not okay. It's not true, really. That is an invention that PTA had. PTA is Paul Thomas Anderson. That guy is not Mackey at all. He is not Mackey. It seemed important for Cruise to establish this. I worked on creating that character with Paul Thomas Anderson for 4 months, and I didn't use that guy at all. Later, I researched this. When asked how he'd come up with the character of T.J. Mackey in an interview in Creative Screenwriting in 2000, however, Paul Thomas Anderson did mention researching Ross Jeffries. Cruise sat me on his 1000cc Triumph motorcycle and taught me how to start the engine and shift gears. Then he raced around the track, popping wheelies, while I wiped out going 5 miles an hour on his top-of-the-line bike. Afterward, he brought me into his trailer. The walls were covered with pictures of the children he and his ex-wife, Nicole Kidman, had adopted. "Has this Jeffries guy turned his character more Mackey-ish since the movie?" Cruise asked. "He's arrogant and megalomaniacal like Mackey, but he's not as alpha male as Mackey." "I'll tell you something," Cruise said as he sat down at a table spread with finger sandwiches and cold cuts. "When I did that monologue as Mackey, we didn't tell the audience anything about what we were doing, and the guys just started getting pumped up as I was talking. So at the end of the day, PTA and I had to get on the stage and say, 'Look, man, we just want to tell you that where this character is going and what he's saying is not good, and it's not okay.'" Here came the lecture. First Dustin, now Tom Cruise. I couldn't understand it. What was wrong with learning how to meet women? That's what we're here for. It's how the species survives. All I wanted was an evolutionary edge. So why not work at it and learn to do it well, like I'd done with everything else in my life? Who says you're allowed to take lessons in motorcycle riding, but not in interacting with women? I just needed someone to show me how to start the engine and shift to higher gears. And I wasn't hurting anyone. No one was complaining after I slept with them. No one was being lied to. No one was being hurt. They wanted to be seduced. Everyone wants to be seduced. It makes us feel wanted. We made this whole speech because the guys were taking what we were saying and going with it and getting into it. So PTA and I were saying, "Hey man, oh my God, easy." See, I wanted to tell him, seduction is seductive. But I couldn't, because as he remembered that moment, Cruise let out a laugh. And Cruise doesn't laugh like ordinary people. His laugh takes over a room. It comes on just fine. A regular laugh by any standards. You will be laughing too. But then, when the humor subsides, you will stop laughing. At this point, however, Cruz's laugh will just be crescendoing, and he will be making eye contact with you. Ha 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 he he. And you will try to laugh again, to join him, because you know you're supposed to. But it doesn't come out right, because it's not natural. He will squeeze out a couple words sometimes, between chuckles. It's not real, in this case. And then he will stop, as suddenly as he started, and you will be relieved. "Well," I told him, squeezing out the last breath of an awkward laugh, "that's easy for you to say." We spent the next week together, visiting various Scientology buildings. It's no secret that Tom Cruise is a member of the Church of Scientology, a religion, self-help group, charity, cult, and philosophy started by the science fiction writer L. Ron Hubbard in the 1960s. But Cruise had never taken a journalist into that world before. The more I learned about L. Ron Hubbard, the more I realized that he was the exact same personality type as Mystery and Ross Jeffries and Tyler Durden. They were wickedly smart megalomaniacs who knew how to synthesize great bodies of knowledge and experience into personality-driven brands, which they sold to people who didn't feel like they were getting what they needed out of life. They were obsessive students of the principles that guide human behavior, but the ethics of and motivation for their use of those principles made them controversial figures. On our last day together, Cruise took me on a tour of the Scientology Celebrity Center on Hollywood Boulevard, where I saw a classroom full of students being trained to use E-meters, devices that measure skin conductance. When curious civilians come into the church, they're hooked up to E-meters and asked various questions. Afterward, the interviewer goes over the results with them and tells them why they need to join the Church of Scientology to fix their problems. Students were paired up in the classroom, role-playing the various scenarios that can occur during an interview. They had large books spread out in front of them. Everything the interviewer, or auditor in Scientology terms, utters, every response to every contingency, was contained in those books. Nothing was left to chance. No possible convert was going to slip through their hands. What they were rehearsing, I realized, was a form of pickup. Without a rigid structure, rehearsed routines, and troubleshooting tactics, there would be no recruitment. One of my main frustrations with Sarging was repeating the same lines over and over. I was getting tired of asking girls if they thought spells worked, or if they wanted to take the best friends test, or if they noticed how their nose wiggled when they laughed. I just wanted to walk into a set and say, "Love me. I'm style." But after watching the auditors, I began to think that perhaps routines weren't training wheels after all. They were the bike. Every form of demagoguery depends on them. Religion is pickup. Politics is pickup. Life is pickup. Every day we have our routines, which we rely on to make people like us, or to get what we want, or to make someone laugh, or to endure another day without letting anyone know the nasty thoughts we're really thinking about them. After the tour, Cruise and I ate lunch in the Celebrity Center restaurant. He was clean-shaven and ruddy-cheeked, wearing a dark green crew-neck t-shirt that fit his body like a glove. Over a healthy slab of steak, he discussed his values. He believed in learning new things, doing the work required of him, and competing with no one but himself. He was strong-willed, centered, and resolute. Any thinking that must be done, any turmoil that must be resolved, any issue that must be handled, was solved first and foremost in a dialogue between Tom Cruise and himself. "I don't really keep counsel with others," he said. "I'm the kind of person who will think about something, and if I know it's right, I'm not going to ask anybody. I don't go, 'Boy, what do you think about this?' I've made every decision for myself, in my career, in my life." Cruise leaned forward in his chair, resting his elbows in his lap. He was low in his seat and his head was parallel with the surface of the table. As he spoke, he expressed himself through gestures as subtle as changing the aperture of his eyes. The guy was born to sell things. Movies, himself, Scientology, you. Whenever I criticized myself or made an excuse for myself, he jumped down my throat. "I'm sorry," I said at one point, when discussing an article I'd written. "I don't mean to sound like one of those writer guys." "Why are you apologizing? Why not be a writer guy? Who are those guys?" "They're talented people who write about things that people are interested in." Then he continued mockingly, "No, you don't want to be one of those guys who's creative and expressive." He was right. I had thought I was done with gurus, but I needed one more. Tom Cruise was teaching me more about Inner Game than Mystery, Ross Jeffries, Steve P, or my father ever had. He stood up and slammed his fist down on the table, hard, Amog style. "Why don't you want to be one of those guys? Be one of those guys, man. I mean it. That's cool." "Okay, Cruise says it's cool. Case closed." As we talked, I realized that out of all the people I'd met in my lifetime, no one had their head screwed on more tightly than Tom Cruise. And this was a disturbing thought, because nearly every idea Tom Cruise expressed could be found somewhere in the massive writings of L. Ron Hubbard. I discovered this when Cruz had his personal Scientology liaison bring a heavy red book to the table. He opened it to the Scientology Code of Honor, and we discussed it point by point. Set a good example, fulfill your obligations, never need praise or approval or sympathy, don't compromise your own reality. When Cruz promised to send me an invitation for the center's annual Scientology gala, I began to worry that this wasn't about an article for Rolling Stone at all. It was about getting another convert to Scientology. If that was true, he'd pick the wrong person. At most, he was introducing me to a body of knowledge I could draw from, like the writings of Joseph Campbell, or the teachings of the Buddha, or the lyrics of Jay-Z. After our meal and study session, Cruz invited me to the president's room to meet his mother, who was taking a course in the building. "Let me ask you something else about that article you wrote," he said as we walked. "A lot of that stuff is about trying to control people and manipulate situations. Can you imagine all the effort they're putting into that? If they took that effort and put it towards something constructive, who knows what they could accomplish?" The interview ended, the article was published, and Tom Cruise and I would meet again. I would be a different person then, but he would be the same. He would never change. He was an AMOG, and he had AMOG'd me. However, he hadn't converted me. He had his church,